Hello, listeners, and welcome to Western Section Podcasts, the election edition. This is Workshop Manager Ivan Parr. We are interviewing two candidates for President-elect 2026, Angel Ramirez and Michael Carbiner. Before we get into interviews, I'd like to remind you that the candidates' statements are posted on the Western Section homepage along with the ballot. That's at tws-west.org. Again, that's tws-west.org. Remember to vote by September 30th, 2025. We are keeping these interviews completely neutral, so interviewers will not be reacting positively or negatively to the responses. Because Lizzie or I know one or both of these candidates very well, our co-host, senior ESA biologist and former Bay Area chapter president, Erica Walther, will be conducting the interviews. Hello, Erica.
Hello, Ivan. Hello, everyone.
Erica will be joined by Li Hong Chow, a senior biologist and principal at Ironwood Consulting. Welcome, Li Hong.
Hi, Ivan. Hi, everyone.
Our first interview is with Angel Ramirez. Angel, before we get into the questions sent by members, we have three standard questions we ask all of our interviewees. And the first one is, what is your favorite animal?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it fluctuates for me personally from season to season. But my all-time favorite is probably going to have to go to the island scrub jay. But for a long time before that, it was the marine iguana. And that was because I must have seen a documentary somewhere, PBS or something, that talked about some of the species on the Galapagos Islands. And I was just fascinated by the marine iguana. For a long time it was the marine iguana, but currently the island scrub jay is my all-time favorite.
We all started somewhere. What was your first job?
Yeah, technically my first job was helping my dad on construction sites. He's a carpenter. He's been a carpenter for over 30 years. And every school break that I had, every summer, I would be helping my dad on the job site. I'd be cleaning. I'd help them move lumber. They'd be on like the second story and I'd move lumber up to them. But mostly I would just be messing around and building my own little structures with all the scrap pieces of wood and nails I would find. Losing my dad's tools. That was, you know, a job, but it was unpaid, of course. But my first real paid job, I guess, my sister got me working at McDonald's inside of a Walmart in Oxnard. So that was my first paid job. And that was a great job.
What is one piece of advice you'd like to give all of our members?
I think one piece of advice would be to get involved, especially for those who feel alienated or not represented, or you feel like you can't find your people or a group who you really click with, get involved. And I think the rest will come naturally after.
Great. Okay, now we're going to ask questions that were submitted by members. The first are introductory questions to help the listeners get to know you. In about 1 minute, can you tell our listeners, who is Angel Ramirez? What should we know about you?
Yeah, I'm a Chicano hailing from Oxnard, California. And I've been a wildlife biologist for around 7 years. I'm a father to a beautiful baby boy named Rio. And I've always been curious in nature and wildlife since I was a kid. You know, some of my earliest memories are of playing in the dirt and collecting bugs and little Tupperwares and looking at them, observing them, seeing what they're doing. And I would also catch little fence lizards and side blotch lizards in my childhood apartments. I love volunteering. I love being part of the community. I love to give back all the things that I've learned. It feels so good and rewarding to be able to give back things that I've learned in my studies and the various workshops I take outside of work. I'm a big birder, and I felt that it was super necessary to create an organization where folks like me can feel comfortable. And so I created this organization called the Oxnard Birders Club. And essentially, I just take folks out from the community birding. I'm a herper. I love botany. I love fungi. I love to think about ecology. And yeah, that's, I guess that kind of sums it up in a minute.
Thank you, Angel. And how long have you been a member of TWS Western Section, and how has the Western Section benefited for you as a wildlife student or professional?
Yeah, thinking about that question, I've probably been a member since 2019. I had been an officer of the student chapter of TWS at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, where I did my undergrad. Shout out to my fellow board members at that time. You know who you are. And also a big shout out to Dr. John Prine. He was our faculty advisor, and he didn't really give us an option to be involved with the chapter or section level. It was just kind of mandatory. And I love that about him. I really appreciate that, because if not, I wouldn't have attended my first annual meeting with the Western Section in Yosemite at Tayena Lodge. It was just a life-changing experience for me. I was in it for life after, I mean, I'm in it for life after that. I found my people, and I found somewhere where I belong, and I really want others to feel that way as well.
Thank you. What leadership roles have you had specifically pertaining to managing for-profit or nonprofit organizations?
Yeah. So like I said before, I love to volunteer, and I've been leading orgs and volunteering since I was in community college. So during my time in community college, I made an amazing friend and mentor. She is a woman, person of color. Her name's Cami Algiers, who sort of encouraged me to start a biology club at Ventura Community College. And so I did. And that gave me tons of experience with organizing events and gathering people. And later, when I transferred to a four-year university, I joined the student chapter of the Wildlife Society. And like I mentioned before, I founded my own organization, the Oxnard Birders Club, where we kind of operate like a 501c3 nonprofit. And we collaborate with different organizations like Latino Outdoors, the San Ynez Band of Chumash Indians and their environmental office. And I think all that to say, I think a lot of those skills are transferable to this role as president-elect.
Thank you for your answer. We all have a project that we might be a little bit proud of. Tell us a little bit about the project you are most proud of, where the role you played made a measurable impact on the management of a species or habitat.
Mm-hmm. So during my time at Cal Poly and my undergrad, and then later after I graduated, I worked on a really cool long-term, long-running project on the island scrub jay, hence why they're my favorite animal of all time. And in this project, we collected systematic behavioral data on the scrub jay. We monitored their nesting success in the spring, and we banded as many jays as we could catch in the fall. And all that data is used to monitor this really vulnerable species, since they currently exist solely on Santa Cruz Island. And during this time, we also got to work on some really cool side projects that help PhD students conduct their research. We looked at genetics with populations of jays that primarily inhabit oak-dominated parts of the island versus pine-dominated forests. So we got to visit all these really amazing places across Santa Cruz Island. And yeah, I was able to get that job from being involved in an internship with this really awesome program called the Smithsonian Scholars Program. And this is hosted by the UCSB Office of Education and Partnerships. So yeah, I think that is a project where I made the most measurable impact of a species and habitat.
What resources will you provide to our membership on how to navigate the changes to federal programs and laws?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I think first we should seek guidance from our partners to see if we have any similar resources that already exist instead of trying to create a new one. So I think that would be my first approach. That in mind, I think that TWS can really rely on our current connections or possibly create new connections as well that can help us with this issue. And if there are no existing resources, we can create them ourselves. So we have a very active and involved Conservation Affairs Committee who already do a lot of this work. So maybe I envision something like a living document that we can easily update as these changes happen and progress. I think that's where I see this happening.
Thank you, Angel. Next question. What specific actions should TWS take on the threats to public lands and species protections by the current administration's policies?
I believe we should have a more involved approach of working with this organization, the Conservation Affairs Network, that has been doing this work already. They submit comments, they lobby for science-based decision-making and reform. So I think we need to rely on that, rely more heavily on that partnership with the Conservation Affairs Network. Also, you know, we live in this digital era, and I think we should promote these issues over social media. And I feel that more and more people are getting their news and getting their information on recent events from social media. So maybe we can turn to our membership or our existing committees and see if there are any people who are content creators, people that really know how to connect folks to this information in a meaningful way that really sticks.
Thank you. And kind of building off of that, the next question is, given the extreme lack of environmental protections and violations of existing governmental policies, do you think a more activist role is warranted by TWS?
100%, yes. And I think there are some restrictions we have with the Western Section being a 501c3 nonprofit. But that's where our sister orgs come into play. I think we should absolutely have a more assertive but nonpartisan role where we elevate membership voices who are actually doing the groundwork and doing that science-based work that is being undermined and just flat out dismissed by this current administration. And yeah, we should absolutely call out violations of existing protections and highlight and shine light on the false narratives and elevate our members' voices.
Thank you for that answer. Next question. The bylaws of TWS Western Section give a deadline of 30 days to vote for a president-elect nominee. This is virtually no time for members to submit questions, interviews to take place, and the interview podcast to be reviewed, produced, and aired in time for members to use it in their vote, especially in the busy field season. What would you, as president, do to fix this perennial problem?
Yes, I recognize that that's a problem, and I believe there is room to adjust as needed. I think it could be easily fixed by adjusting or tweaking the bylaws, by gathering more time for us to find, to have more meaningful engagement. If that means moving up the date for the calls for nominations, then that's something that we can adjust in the bylaws. Also, I think it would be super beneficial to have sort of a list of folks who are kind of on deck and ready to go that are interested in the role as president. So that way we kind of have people to fill in as the terms come to an end. And I recently learned that this is something similar that the faculty advisors have something similar in place where as they would like, as faculty advisors to student chapters, as they like to phase out or they no longer want to fill in that role, they have a list of people, they have a list of faculty who are able to fill in for them as they transition out of that role. So yeah, I think that's something that we can do.
Thank you. One of the jobs of president-elect is to help organize the annual conference. What would a 2027 annual conference look like under your vice presidency?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we have a great annual meeting already going, and but I would like to put some more emphasis on diversity and networking. And I think it would be amazing to include some presenters from orgs like Latino Outdoors, Black AF and STEM, Hunters of Color, just to name a few. Also, I'd like to... Also, I've come to know some folks who are doing really great work in their communities who don't necessarily have an academic background, and they're sort of DIY, self-taught community scientists. And I think it would be awesome to have them come and present or even host a workshop. And lastly, I think I would want to see more botany-related talks and posters, because you can't really study wildlife without talking about their ecology and the plant life that they rely on. But, you know, overall, I think the Western Section has a really great thing going with the annual meeting. And, inserting my little flair on it, I think that would be my only adjustment.
Thank you, Angel. You might have already addressed this, but the next question is, what concrete ways would you support the section's ongoing commitment to supporting young professionals, wildlife biologists of color, and or those that identify as LGBTQ+?
Yes, I think the Western Section does a really great job so far. Our diversity committee, shout out to Thea and the student and early career professionals committee. They do a really great job at supporting people who identify with these groups. And we offer a ton of cool grants to support people who identify in these groups. However, that being said, I think there can always be room to grow and to do better. And that's where I encourage the membership to speak out and get your voice heard. Because if you feel that you're not being represented, or you feel that you don't have the right support, then that's when you need to voice your opinion and really speak out. So, yeah.
Great. Next question. What is your stance on changing North American bird names?
This is the heated topic. But I'm in full support of this change. Bird names for birds. I think it's a really interesting and important step towards a better future for birding and for birders. And I think it's a decision that was made with a lot of care and delicate approach. And it wasn't just a simple decision. And also, I just learned that there used to be a single committee within AOS, a group of taxonomists that designated the official, you know, scientific names as well as the American common names. But now they've separated this where they let the taxonomists focus on the taxonomy. And they have a separate committee who focus on the bird names. And I think that's really, I think that's good. And I think that's really important because the committee that focuses on common names are not solely taxonomists. They're people of various backgrounds. They're writers, historians, they're poets. And I think that's a great thing. And for anybody who's interested, there's also a really cool project that just came out called AviList for a unified global checklist of birds that's also going to be serving kind of like a living checklist. So I encourage people to check that out.
Thank you, Angel. And our last question is, invertebrates have been ignored by wildlife biologists for far too long. In light of global insect declines, what can we do or what policies should we support?
that's an interesting question. And I will have to disagree with this question a little bit. I don't think that the inverts have been ignored by wildlife biologists. But I do agree that they have been pushed aside for far too long. And I feel that this is the similar case with fungi. And I think that the Western section can help in a variety of ways. For example, like hosting dedicated sessions at the annual meeting and even dedicated workshops that are invert focused. And as I was thinking about this question, I thought back to when I was in undergrad, and one of the coolest field trips that I did was doing benthic macroinvertebrate sampling in a creek. And that was just like one of the coolest things that I did at that point in time. And maybe we can have something like that. Maybe that's something that Ivan can host, being the workshop manager, or maybe it's something that we can host at the annual meeting. And also, we can offer grants to folks who are doing invertebrate work, sort of highlighting their work in our platforms. I think that's a great first step to drive more overarching policy awareness with the global decline of insects.
Thank you, Angel Ramirez, for joining us this evening for your interview for Western Section President-elect. Our next candidate that will be interviewed is Michael Carabiner.
Our second interview is with Michael Carabiner. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the questions sent by the members, we have three standard questions we ask all of our interviewees.
And the first one is, what is your favorite animal?
Yeah, you know, I had to think about this a bit because I think it kind of varies depending on my mood. But I'm going to go with the Pleocoma fimbriata, the fimbriate rain beetle. And the reason is that it It's had an impact on my life in a couple of points in my life. First off, when I was in college at San Jose State, I was at an ecology field trip and I saw these big scarab beetles flying around and I caught a couple of them and took them back. And it turned out it was this species and it was an undocumented observation. So it was sort of not a new population, but a population that had been unknown. That was cool. Got really into it and then forgot all about them for 20 plus years until I moved to Placerville and the first rain of the season happened and these things were flying all over my property. It's generally a rare species that can be locally abundant if you're in the right spot. And I just happen to buy property that's in the right spot. So every year I look forward to these little guys. And that's currently my favorite animal.
Thank you for your answer, Michael. Your next question is, what was your first job?
Yeah, sure. My first job was actually, I was a dishwasher at a Chinese food restaurant in the small town I grew up in Washington. I actually made less than minimum wage and managed to get by on that by eating a whole lot of free barbecued pork that they would give us. And my brother and I both worked there and we would dip it in the hottest mustard that they had and then cough and hack with the horseradishy nasally situation. But my first real job, kind of biology job, I think, was in college. I did a couple of internships. The first one, and probably the coolest one, was I, as part of the Student Conservation Association, I went over to the Smoky Mountains National Park and participated in a park-wide spider survey. So we collected thousands of spiders. That was a pretty cool project.
Thank you for that. Next question. What is one piece of advice you'd like to give all members?
Yeah, you know, I thought about this one a little bit, and I was going to say communicate, because it's something that I have not always been the best at, and I've really learned the value of, but to me, I feel like leaning into your ethics and sticking to your ethics is probably the best advice I can give anybody in this field. I think it's our responsibility to work in a non-biased and ethical manner. And I found that often there's a tendency to work and push for your client's position, whatever that is. And I've been asked to compromise my values at times. And I haven't. I hold that ethical standard dear to my heart. And when I went for my certified wildlife biology certification, one of the people I asked for a reference said, "Oh yeah, absolutely, you're one of the good ones." And I think that comment was directly related to me being ethical and not willing to give up those values. I feel like we can do a lot of things wrong. We could be poor writers. We could be poor communicators. We can just be mean or not a great person to be around. But people will forgive that. They will work with you. They will help you. But the second you show that you're not an ethical person, it's pretty much game over. And you lose the trust of your cohorts. So I would say, stick to your ethics, lean into them, and use those to guide your life.
Okay. Now we're going to ask some questions submitted by members. First, our introductory questions to help the listener get to know you a little bit better. In about a minute, can you tell the listener who is Michael Carviner? What should we know about you?
Sure. I struggled with this one because I think like most of us, I don't like talking about myself. I feel like I'm just any other person that has been lucky enough to get a job and work in this field. And I've managed to do it for now going on 30 years. And that, looking back on my life when I was a kid, I was not a very motivated kid. I didn't do well in high school. I didn't do well immediately after high school. And I look back at that and I just cannot imagine that I got to where I got. You know, I eventually got tired of just putzing around with my life, and I went back and started with community college and plugged away at that, and then got into San Jose State and plugged away at that. While in college, I think I mentioned this in your previous question, but I kind of did everything I could to get experience. And so that involved a couple of pretty hard internships that didn't pay anything. And I had to put everything into storage and go, you know, live out of my vehicle or live in a free place in the park. But doing that gave me the experience to kind of leverage an actual position. And so, you know, I've moved around a bit, and now I'm back at PG&E as a supervisor in the veg management and short cycle team, for environmental, obviously. One other thing about me, and I know I'm probably babbling on here, but I've struggled my whole life, really, with being incredibly shy and having almost crippling social anxiety at times. And it's funny because I think a lot of people that know me would not think that at all, because I can be sort of the class clown, sort of very gregarious at times, but inside I'm just often really struggling to mingle, to go down to the conference and hit the poster session because I'm going to have to talk to people. And so that honestly is one of my big motivations for running for president, is to reach out to people that struggle with that aspect and help them figure out that they're worth the trouble, they're worth doing this, and they can do this.
Thank you for your answer, Michael. Your next question: how long have you been a member of TWS Western Section, and how has the Western Section benefited you as a wildlife student or professional?
Sure. I first joined the Western Section in 2000. That said, I kind of went away from wildlife for a while and focused on fisheries, and there was a pretty big break in my membership with the Western Section and the Wildlife Society in general. I rejoined in 2017, and that was as a result of, again, being more reptile, amphibian focused, and wanting to just get some more information, meet some people, and learn a little bit more about it. As far as how the Western Section has benefited me, I've definitely expanded and maintained a lot of professional relationships. I've met new friends through the Western Section. I've networked in ways I didn't honestly think was possible or didn't really do necessarily in the AFS or life in general because of some of my social anxiety. But I found that the Western Section is so friendly and so welcoming that it's made that easier. I've taken multiple workshops, and I've learned about all kinds of new species and survey techniques and BMPs and how to handle those species. And then obviously the conferences are fantastic for information and to meet some really cool and knowledgeable people. I also eventually, a few years ago, went after and achieved my certified wildlife biologist status. And so the workshop on that, as well as some mentorship from some of the key people involved in that, really helped me put together my application in a way that would get approved and help me figure out which courses I needed, where I might be a little bit deficient, and who to reach out to help with that. So it's been a godsend for me. I think the society, like anything, is what you make of it. I have not always made much of it or the best of it. And a lot of it is due to my anxiety around being in public or being around large groups of people. It's something that I've worked really hard to change. And it's something that I hope that we can bring to the Western section to include people that really struggle with that. Cause I suspect there's a lot of us that do. I think it's kind of one of the natures of our industry is that we tend to be a little more shy, a little more withdrawn than a lot of industries.
Thank you, Michael. What leadership roles have you had specifically pertaining to managing for-profit or nonprofit organizations?
Yeah, I've been leading teams or crews pretty much my entire career. I've mostly been a field biologist, so very field-oriented, both in fisheries and wildlife. And early on, I remember my first position at Santa Clara Valley Water District. I was with kind of a group of biologists that were hired on a contract basis. And very quickly, my supervisor recognized that leadership quality in me and put me in charge of multiple salmonid studies. And I've always sort of been in that role. And I've gone really far to mentor a lot of people. A couple of years ago, I received what I consider to be the greatest compliment I've ever gotten when a coworker of mine went to work for another consulting firm and was talking to another biologist there. And my name came up. And the other biologist told him, you know, Michael has taught me everything I know about fisheries biology. And looking at it, I'm not entirely sure that that's a compliment or not, but I took it as a compliment. I've been a certified project manager for over 15 years. And I've held supervising positions at multiple firms. I used to, as I mentioned, be pretty active with the American Fisheries Society. Particularly the CalNEVA chapter, and was on the XCOM or executive committee for that chapter, where we planned both a national conference in San Francisco. I think it was the 2000s. I don't remember which conference it was, honestly, 2014. And then the next year we planned the CalNEVA conference, and I was involved with the continuing education of that. I do believe that a leader is really only as good as the people that are around that person. And it's a leader's position and responsibility to listen, take the information from the experts and the people that are really in the know, and then use that information accordingly. And quite frankly, I think the Western section has a great team of people that know what they're doing. And so the idea that I'm going to come in and be in charge, I think, is a little egotistical. I don't think that's the case. I think my role is, again, to let those people do what they do, provide some guidance and leadership, and move forward.
Thank you for your answer, Michael. Y'all have a project that we're most proud of. Tell us about a project you are most proud of, where the role you played
made a measurable impact on the management of a species or habitat?
Sure. I have a couple, but one that I really think makes a difference or made a difference was the San Clemente Dam Removal and Carmel River Reroute Project. And what this project entailed was the removal of a dam in the Carmel River, which had sedimented in and was non-functional. And there's both a steelhead run in that river as well as red-legged frogs that utilize the reservoir of the river. And so I was one of the lead biologists I was in charge of preparing the biological assessments for both NIMS as well as U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and negotiating those terms with the agencies. The project itself, the plan was to reroute the river around the reservoir altogether so that we didn't cause a slug of sediment to move downstream and create bigger impacts down there, and then remove the dam once that river has been rerouted around the reservoir and restore the reservoir area. And so there were a couple of things that I did that I felt really made a difference. One was the original access route to access the reroute channel and the back end of the reservoir was going to come in off Coshagua Road. And it went right next to this pond, that actually had an unrecorded, occurrence of California tiger salamander. And so it didn't show up on any of our CNDB hits or anywhere else. And so, Fish and Wildlife Service alerted us to this, and I worked with the design engineers to find a new access road into the site from a completely different area and avoid that pond altogether. And we were, as a result, able to remove CTS completely from that biological assessment and associated biological opinion. The second thing I think I did on that project that was pretty cool was worked with the design team both on designing the red-legged frog ponds, breeding ponds in the reservoir footprint to, I think the original design was just 3 feet or less, dry up every other year. But we worked with them to create some pockets, some habitat, and be a little bit more realistic with what we expected there. And then I provided input on the restoration palette of trees along the riparian corridor, with the goal of increasing input for invertebrates for the steelhead to feed on. And so that project resulted in about 25 miles of additional spawning and rearing habitat for those steelhead.
What resources will you provide to our membership on how to navigate the changes to federal programs to laws?
I had a few thoughts on this. One, I think this would be a really good opportunity for a workshop. A lot of our workshops are very species focused, and I feel like we could work with an environmental lawyer to provide opportunities to keep our memberships informed through newsletters, podcasts, Zoom calls, things like that. And I think we could probably put some updates on the Western Section's website, but things are coming really fast and furious with this administration. And I feel like it would potentially be a lot to keep up with. And I feel like perhaps some sort of workshop or avenue to provide information on what's changing and how to navigate those changes. I also feel like an important part is how we speak with those of us around or those around us, You know, our friends and family don't always have the same level of understanding or even concern for what's happening. And I think a lot of times we speak at a different level and it's not quite understood. And so having some coaching, having some guidance on, okay, there's all these big words and they're telling us we need to do this and we should do that and we can't do this anymore. How do we make that digestible? How do we take that information and discuss it with those around us in a way that will make them understand our point of view and maybe deal with it? As far as how to navigate these changes for our members, I think it's an iterative process. And I think a lot of it is it's information. We have to inform them and we have to try to find ways to engage them.
Thank you for that answer, Michael. Next question. What specific actions should TWS take on the threats to public lands and species protections by the current administration's policies?
Well, I think it's our responsibility to respond with scientific and factual information on these issues. I also feel like we should be arming our members with that information so that they can respond and act accordingly. But I also feel like we need to be careful in how we do this. We need to be proactive, not reactive. I think a lot of what we're seeing from this administration is done out of spite, and it's done strictly to gain a reaction that is then used against that particular reaction. So I think we need to think hard about what our positions are, and we need to state them in a way that is difficult to be refuted. We've got to not be opinion-based. We've got to not get angry and frustrated. We're scientists. We need to come at it from a factual point of view, without speaking above the level of our audience. What can we actually do? We have a Conservation Affairs Committee who responds to various changes in the regulations, and I think we should lean on that committee. I think more people should volunteer to be a part of that committee and get involved, and we should be commenting on those issues when they affect what we worry about. You know, one thing I thought of, which would be a really cool option, is we've got all of these funds getting cut and programs getting cut. And what if there was a way where we could connect with these researchers who have just lost their funding, and our members could provide help to either do field work, data analysis, help them prepare the reports, review the reports, submit the reports, what have you. And it's sort of a win-win. It might allow some of these researchers to continue their work, and it might allow some of our members to gain valuable experience that they don't have an opportunity to get, especially since all of these things are being cut right now.
Given the extreme lack of environmental protections and violations of existing governmental policies, do you think a more activist role is warranted by TWS?
I think we need to be really careful in this regard. I went and looked at our bylaws, and they state that the objectives of the Western section are, and I'm going to read this now, to encourage the highest standards in all activities of the wildlife profession, to recognize and commend outstanding work in the profession and in other efforts of wildlife conservation and ecology, and here's the important one, to support and promote the activities and objectives of the society and chapters within the section regarding wildlife needs, problems, and events in the Western section area. Now, that said, one of the implementation goals of the bylaws is to evaluate and respond to proposed or enacted social actions that could affect wildlife or its habitats. But I also went into the Western Section strategic plan and looked at that. And it goal four says, be an active voice for science. Further down in that strategic plan, it makes it very clear that because we are a nonprofit, true activism is not appropriate for the Western Section itself. So I feel like we need to recognize and think about the difference between advocacy and activism. And I think that the Western Section should be more of an advocate. It should be calling for, it should be working to support our cause, but doing true activism is not, it's not something in our strategic plan. It's not something we should be doing. I think we should be engaging with the public to educate them about the benefits of wildlife conservation. I think we should engage and interact more closely with other organizations, American Fisheries Society, the Entomology Society. I think by educating people, we can help to promote these views, and we can provide our members with action and with an understanding that they can then take and do their own activism.
Thank you, Michael. Speaking of bylaws, the bylaws of TWS Western Section give a deadline of 30 days to vote for a president-elect nominee. This is virtually no time for members to submit questions, interviews to take place, and the interview podcast to be reviewed, produced, and aired in time for members to use it in their vote, especially in the busy field season. What would you, as president, do to fix this perennial problem?
Yeah, this rushing to get nominees thing and to elect a president and go through all of this process is definitely a problem. I don't think anybody wants it to be this way, and it doesn't have to be. Again, I looked at the bylaws, and they actually don't say that. What they say is, notice seeking nominees will be provided to membership at least 30 days prior to announcing the nomination slate, and the nomination slate for president-elect shall be submitted to the membership at least 30 days prior to the annual meeting. So we've sort of left out that at least part, and I think we need to bring that back in. I think we need to push harder to get nominees early on in the process, and then I think we need to open up the voting and the entire time frame for this process. You know, it's nerve-wracking waiting to find out, did I win? Did I lose? You know, da 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 da. But the reality is, I don't want people to make a flip decision. I don't want people to have to vote before this podcast comes out and gives them a little more information on who they think is the most appropriate candidate. And quite frankly, I think there should be more time to get more candidates, stronger candidates, whatever we feel is more appropriate. But that's what I would do as president, is I would advocate to start the process earlier and extend the process as long as we can that's feasible.
Sure, as you know, one of the jobs of president-elect is to help organize the annual conference. What would a 2027 annual conference look like under your vice presidency?
You know, the Western Section does an amazing job with their conferences. I've been to other conferences, and I just feel like our conferences are incredibly well organized. I think our group does a great job. I do have a few ideas. I feel like one of the things we really could be doing is reaching out to high school students. Get these people in there earlier. See if there's an opportunity to allow a certain number of of young people in that may not even know that this exists or is an opportunity. I also feel like, you know, we usually will have a day, maybe 2 days prior to the actual conference where we have field trips or workshops. And as somebody who struggles with going down and mingling with people, I'd like to see more maybe smaller, less formal outings, you know? If I'm not mistaken, the 2027 conference is in Reno. So maybe morning bird watching sessions where, you know, you sign up, maybe there's a session you're not super into, and you sign up and 6 or 7 people go out and look for birds. Maybe there's an evening drive out into the desert to do tracking or look for some wild horses and discuss that issue. Less formal, more allowing people to get into a smaller group and make a couple friends and then kind of leverage that into being more comfortable with our situation. I feel like we should be reaching out to other groups. You know, a few years ago, we had the Western section and the National Conference in Reno. And I think it would be great if we could reach out to some of these other conservation groups or societies and see if they want to either present or have their conference or some sort of conference at the same time as ours, and we can kind of cross train and cross learn a little bit. Ask if they could teach a workshop for us. You know, we had the bumblebee workshop, but that's kind of one of, well, we got the monarch one coming up, but that's kind of one of the only invert workshops we've got. You know, there's wildlife is everywhere, and it's so codependent on everything else, plants, insects, fish, all of that stuff. I'd also like to figure out, and this isn't really about the conference, but speaking of our workshops, you know, they sell out so fast. And I hear from so many people, and I've experienced this, that, oh, I couldn't get it onto it because there was a wait list and it sold out in 3 minutes. And so figuring out a way to make those a little more public, you know, make that opportunity happen for more people, whether there's more sessions, whether we just open it up to more people, I don't know. But I also feel like having some workshops on some of the other skills that are required as a wildlife biologist, you know, I just recently reviewed a bunch of resumes, and all the resumes I reviewed had tons of field work, permits, and all of this. And then the feedback from some of our reviewers was, well, they can't write a report. There's nothing in here about writing a report. There's nothing in here about agency negotiations. And giving people that opportunity to put something on their resume that will allow them to get more than just field help jobs, I think would be a very valuable thing.
Next question. What concrete ways would you support the section's ongoing commitment to supporting young professionals, wildlife biologists of color, and or those that identify as LGBTQ+?
As the question suggests, I feel like the Western section does a fantastic job of supporting inclusiveness and supporting members from marginalized communities. Our current administration has put extreme pressure on federal agencies and others to get rid of this, to stop it altogether. I'm lucky enough to work for PG&E, who absolutely supports those communities and has kind of an approach and a motto of bring your authentic self to work. And I firmly believe in that. I feel like one of the things we can really do to further that goal, I again, I think we do a pretty good job now of supporting the people in our industry in these groups. But I, again, would love to go reach out to high schoolers, elementary schoolers, especially in some of these underserved communities. They're not being exposed to biology. They're not being exposed to the outdoors. And if we were able to go to these people and bring them into the fold early on in their lives, we might be able to make a better change, a bigger change.
What is your stance on changing North American bird names?
This is the question I struggled with the most. And I went back and forth on it. I talked to several people about this and got their opinions on it. And I'm still on the fence. I'm not going to lie. I don't have a very strong stance on it. I understand both sides of the issue. On one hand, should we really be naming birds after people that may not be great people? Should we be celebrating racists and slave owners and sometimes horrible people? No, absolutely not. On the flip side, it's a name. It's a common name. And it's what, you know, birding is a little different in that you've got a huge network of non-biologist people that are super into birding. Many of them are elderly. Many of them have been doing this for a long time and have very strong opinions. I feel like anytime we start changing names, it causes confusion and strife. There's a part of me that feels like if you start changing names because they might represent, say, a racist or a poor, you know, an evil person, does that, we've seen this happen with, you know, military bases and other things around the country where we've changed these names, and then the people that we are changing them, say racists, they're the ones that get mostly offended, and they're the ones that are going to react even more. And so are we just fueling the fire by doing this? And I don't know. I've gone back and forth. I get both sides of it. I don't really have a strong opinion on this. And I guess I feel like I would support whatever the membership wants to do on it. I've thought about this for many days now, and I don't have a good answer.
Thank you for that, Michael. Last question. Invertebrates have been ignored by wildlife biologists for far too long. In light of global insect declines, what can we do, or what policies should we support?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with this completely. I don't think we often consider at how valuable invertebrates are to wildlife conservation and populations. You know, if you look at caribou herds up in Alaska, they're greatly affected by mosquito populations. Another example is termite mounds in the Okavango Delta. I've been there, and one thing that struck me about being there was the guide telling me, you know, hey, without these termite mounds, this delta would pretty much be more or less flat. It would not have the structure and the geography that would allow what occurs there. And so they're more than just food. They're more than just another animal. I absolutely support the recent appeals court decision that labeled bumblebees as fish. It did that due to the definition of what a fish is, and It stated that it could include invertebrates and it didn't call out aquatic invertebrates. And so that was used and that was great. And I love when we're able to use some of these regulations in ways to benefit our conservation. I would love to see more invertebrate discussions at our conferences. I would like to see more focus on it. I think one of the things is we don't necessarily consider these things until they're threatened or endangered or about to be listed. And then everybody jumps on it and they're like, oh, I've got to take that bumblebee class because I want to get a handling permit for it. I want to be the guy at my company that's the go-to person for that species. And I don't necessarily think that's the right approach. I think we should be thinking about what these things offer and where they are in the scheme of things. You know, maybe we could have another workshop idea is invertebrate wildlife interactions and managing for wildlife based upon some sort of management for invertebrates. You know, it's frustrating to me when I see that we only care about a species when it becomes endangered. You know, we all want to be that bumblebee guy right now, but how many people want to learn about rain beetles?
Thank you, Michael Carbeter, for running for president-elect for the Western Section of the Wildlife Society and for answering our members' questions tonight. Thank you for tuning in to Western Section Podcasts. It has been a pleasure meeting president-elect candidates for 2026, Michael Carbeter and Angel Ramirez. A reminder that votes are due September 30th and can be cast from the Western Section homepage at tws-west.org.
Our hosts for this podcast have been Erica Walser and Li Hong Chow. We'd like to thank our producer, Brandon Noonan, project manager, Candace Springer, and former program director, Cynthia Parade. Our podcast committee members includes Brandon Noonan, Erica Walser, Elizabeth Meisman, and Ivan Parr. To all of our members, please stay safe and healthy, and
be part of something wilder.